Chapter 12. Yet blameless, pointed to their pink corsets and transparent hosiery. Presently Arnie found that his watch had stopped and turned in at a small jeweler's shop which chanced to still be open. While the watch was being examined, Charity leaned over the glass counter where, on a background of dark blue velvet, pins, rings, and brooches glittered like the moon and stars. She had never seen jewelry so nearby, and she longed to lift the glass lid and plunge her hand among the shining treasures. But already Arnie's watch was repaired, and he laid his hand on her arm and drew her from her dream. "Which do you like best?" he asked, leaning over the counter at her side. "I don't know. ... She pointed to a gold lily of the valley with white flowers. "Don't you think the blue pin's better?" he suggested, and immediately she saw that the lily of the valley was mere trumpery compared to the small round stone, blue as a mountain lake, with little sparks of light all around it. She colored at her want of discrimination. "It's so lovely, I guess I was afraid to look at it," she said. He laughed, and they went out of the shop, but a few steps away he exclaimed, "By Jove, I forgot something," and turned back and left her in the crowd. She stood staring down a row of pink gramophone throats till he rejoined her and slipped his arm through hers. "You mustn't be afraid of looking at the blue pin any longer, because it belongs to you," he said, and she felt a little box being pressed into her hand. Her heart gave a leap of joy, but it reached her lips only in a shy stammer. She remembered other girls whom she had heard planning to extract presents from their fellows, and was seized with a sudden dread lest Arnie should have imagined that he had leaned over the pretty things in the glass case in the hope of having one given to her. A little farther down the street they turned in at a glass doorway opening on a shining hall with a mahogany staircase and brass cages in its corners. "He must have something to eat," Arnie said. And the next moment Charity found herself in a dressing room all looking glass and lustrous surfaces, where a party of showy looking girls were dabbing on powder and straightening immense plumed hats. When they had gone she took courage to bathe her hot face in one of the marble basins, and to straighten her own hat brim, which the parasols of the crowd had indented. The dresses in the shops had so impressed her that she scarcely dared look at her reflection. But when she did so, the glow of her face under her cherry-colored hat, and the curve of her young shoulders through the transparent muslin, restored her courage. And when she had taken the blue brooch from its box, and pinned it on her bosom, she walked toward the restaurant with her head high, as if she had always strolled through tessellated halls beside young men in flannels. Her spirit sank a little at the sight of the slim-waisted waitresses in black, with bewitching mob caps on their haughty heads, who were moving disdainfully between the tables. One of them dropped to Arnie in passing, and he stood doubtfully glancing about him. "Oh, well, we can't stay sweltering here," he decided. "Let's try somewhere else," and with a sense of relief Charity followed him from that scene of inhospitable splendor. That somewhere else turned out, after more hot tramping, and several failures, to be, of all things, a little open-air place in a back street that called itself a French restaurant, and consisted in two or three rickety tables under a scarlet runner, between a patch of zinnias and petunias, and a big elm bending over from the next yard. Here they lunched on queerly flavored things, while Arnie, leaning back in a crippled rocking chair, smoked cigarettes between the courses and poured into Charity's glass a pale yellow wine which he said was the very same one drank in just such jolly places in France. Charity did not think the wine as good as Sarsaparilla, but she sipped a mouthful for the pleasure of doing what he did, and of fancying herself alone with him in foreign countries. The illusion was increased by their being served by a deep-bosomed woman with smooth hair and a pleasant laugh, who talked to Arnie in unintelligible words, and seemed amazed and overjoyed at his answering her in kind. At the other tables other people sat, mill hands probably, homely but pleasant-looking, who spoke the same shrill jargon, and looked at Arnie and Charity with friendly eyes, And between the table legs a poodle with bald patches, and pink eyes nosed about for scraps, and sat up on his hind legs absurdly. Harney showed no inclination to move, for hot as their corner was, it was at least shaded and quiet, and, from the main thoroughfares came the clanging of trolleys, the incessant popping of torpedoes, the jingle of street organs, the bawling of megaphone men and the loud murmur of increasing crowds. He leaned back, smoking his cigar, patting the dog, and stirring the coffee that steamed in their chipped cups. "Tea's the real thing, you know," he explained, and Charity hastily revised her previous conception of the beverage. They had made no plans for the rest of the day, and when Harney asked her what she wanted to do next, she was too bewildered by rich possibilities to find an answer. Finally, she confessed that she longed to go to the lake, whereas he had not been taken on her former visit, and when he answered, "Oh, there's time for that, it will be pleasanter later," she suggested seeing some pictures like the ones Mr. Miles had taken her to. She thought Harney looked a little disconcerted, but he passed his fine handkerchief over his warm brow, said gaily, "Come along, then," and rose with a last pat for the pink-eyed dog. Mr. Miles' pictures had been shown in an austere YMCA hall, with white walls and an organ, but Harney led Charity to a glittering place. Everything she saw seemed to glitter where they passed, between immense pictures of yellow-haired beauties stabbing villains in evening dress, into a velvet-curtained auditorium packed with spectators to the last limit of compression. After that, for a while, everything was merged in her brain in swimming circles of heat and blinding alternations of light and darkness. All the world has to show seemed to pass before her in a chaos of palms and minarets, charging cavalry regiments, roaring lions, comic policemen and scowling murderers, and the crowd around her, the hundreds of hot sallow candy-munching faces, young, old, middle-aged, but all kindled with the same contagious excitement, became part of the spectacle, and danced on the screen with the rest. Presently the thought of the cool trolley run to the lake grew irresistible, and they struggled out of the theater. As they stood on the pavement, Harney pale with the heat, and even Charity a little confused by it, a young man drove by in an electric runabout with a calico band bearing the words, $10 to take you around the lake." Before Charity knew what was happening, Harney had waved a hand, and they were climbing in. For 25 I'll run you out to see the ball game and back," the driver proposed with an insinuating grin, but Charity said quickly, I'd rather go rowing on the lake." The street was so thronged that progress was slow, but the glory of sitting in the little carriage, while it wriggled its way between laden omnibuses and trolleys, made the moment seem too short. "Next turn is Lake Avenue," the young man called out over his shoulder, and as they paused in the wake of a big omnibus groaning with knights of Pythias in cocked hats and swords, Charity looked up and saw on the corner a brick house with a conspicuous black and gold sign across its front. "Dr. Merkel, private consultations at all hours. Lady attendants," she read, and suddenly she remembered Eli Haw's words. "He house was at the corner of Wing Street and Lake Avenue. There's a big black sign across the front. Through all the heat and the rapture a shiver of cold ran over her. The lake at last, a sheet of shining metal brooded over by drooping trees. Charity and Harney had secured a boat, and, getting away from the wharves and the refreshment booths, they drifted idly along, hugging the shadow of the shore. Where the sun struck the water, its shafts flamed back blindingly at the heat-veiled sky, and the least shade was black by contrast. The lake was so smooth that the reflection of the trees on its edge seemed enameled on a solid surface, but gradually, as the sun declined, the water grew transparent, and Charity, leaning over, plunged her fascinated gaze into depths so clear that she saw the inverted treetops interwoven with the green growths of the bottom. They rounded a point at the farther end of the lake, and entering an inlet pushed their bow against a protruding tree trunk. A green veil of willows overhung them. Beyond the trees, wheat fields sparkled in the sun, and all along the horizon the clear hills throbbed with light. Charity leaned back in the stern, and Arnie unshipped the oars, and lay in the bottom of the boat without speaking. Ever since their meeting at the Crescent Pool he had been subject to these brooding silences, which were as different as possible from the pauses when they ceased to speak, because words were needless. At such times his face wore the expression as he had seen on it, when as he had looked in at them from the darkness, and again there came over her a sense of the mysterious distance between them. But usually his fits of abstraction were followed by bursts of gaiety that chased away the shadow before it chilled her. She was still thinking of the $10 he had handed to the driver of the runabout. It had given them 20 minutes of pleasure, and it seemed unimaginable that anyone should be able to buy amusement at that rate. With $10 he might have bought her an engagement ring. She knew that Mrs. Tom Fry's, which came from Springfield, and had a diamond in it, had cost only $8.75. But she did not know why the thought had occurred to her. Harney would never buy her an engagement ring. They were friends and comrades, but no more. He had been perfectly fair to her. He had never said a word to mislead her. She wondered what the girl was like whose age, and was waiting for his ring. Boats were beginning to thicken on the lake, and the clang of incessantly arriving trolleys announced the return of the crowds from the ball field. The shadows lengthened across the pearl-gray water and two white clouds near the sun were turning golden. On the opposite shore men were hammering hastily at a wooden scaffolding in a field. Charity asked what it was for. Why, the fireworks. I suppose there'll be a big show. Harney looked at her, and a smile crept into his moody eyes. Ave, you never seen any good fireworks? Miss Hatcher always sends up lovely rockets on the 4th, she answered doubtfully. Oh, his contempt was unbounded. Mean a big performance like this, illuminated boats, and all the rest. She flushed at the picture. Oh, they send them up from the lake too? Rather. Didn't you notice that big raft we passed? It's wonderful to see the rockets completing their orbits down under one's feet. She said nothing, and he put the oars into the rowlocks. If we stay we'd better go, and pick up something to eat. But how can we get back afterwards? She ventured, feeling it would break her heart if she missed it. He consulted a timetable, found a 10 o'clock train and reassured her. The moon rises so late that it will be dark by 8, and we'll have over an hour of it. Twilight fell, and lights began to show along the shore. The trolleys roaring out from Nettleton became great luminous serpents coiling in and out among the trees. The wooden eating houses at the lake's edge danced with lanterns, and the dusk echoed with laughter and shouts and the clumsy splashing of oars. Harney and Charity had found a table in the corner of a balcony built over the lake, and were patiently awaiting an unattainable chowder. Close under them the water lapped the piles, agitated by the evolutions of a little white steamboat trellised with colored globes which was to run passengers up and down the lake. It was already black with them as it sheered off on its first trip. Suddenly Charity heard a woman's laugh behind her. The sound was familiar, and she turned to look. A band of showily dressed girls and dapper young men wearing badges of secret societies, with new straw hats tilted far back on their square-clipped hair, had invaded the balcony and were loudly clamoring for a table. The girl in the lead was the one who had laughed. She wore a large hat with a long white feather, and from under its brim her painted eyes looked at Charity with amused recognition. Say, if this ain't like old home week, she remarked to the girl at her elbow, and giggles and glances. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.